Thank you for taking the time to listen to this message from Stonebridge United Methodist Church. We hope you find it has meaning and relevance for your life. And now may you be blessed as you hear the reading of God's Word.
I will be reading from Timothy 6:17 through 19. As for those who are in the present age are rich, command them not to be haughty, or to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but rather on God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. They are to do good, to be rich in good works, generously, and ready to share, thus storing up for themselves the treasure of a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of the life that really is life.
Thank you, John. This is a curious passage when we talk about the life that really is life, and it reminds me of a story that my life story goes from Allen, Texas to TCU, which I didn't appreciate that Go Mustangs earlier. That was a tragic event. To out in Atlanta to Emory University to do seminary. And while I was off in Atlanta doing seminary at Emory, my wife chose a more fruitful path of going and backpacking through Europe for about 3 months and experiencing all of that. And then got a job near Boston in a city called Natick. And now the one business thing is I've traveled around the country in various different places, even a little bit internationally. The one business advice that I would give you that I've learned through these different travels is to open a Dairy Queen. It's just the surefire way that you will always stay in business and make a huge profit out of this, because from Georgia all across I-20 back to Dallas, all through the Southwest, up through Kansas, up even in the Northeast, I have experienced Dairy Queens, and they are never empty, with the exception of this one time. Because if you go up into Boston in Natick, we were driving from Natick to Wellesley one time, I remember, and I think we were going to have dinner, we're going to walk around Wellesley College, or, you know, she was kind of showing me around. I'd never been up there before. And we drive past, and there's this little Dairy Queen stand up near Boston. Now, me and Lindsay would fly back and forth to visit each other while we were apart from each other. And I never really expected to see a Dairy Queen. I always thought it was like the Texas road stop and the Texas stop sign. I never expected to see one up in the Northeast, because those people are weird up there, and they don't know good stuff. And so... If you know someone from the Northeast that's weird, just raise your hand. We all know those people, yeah. And so we're driving, I see this Dairy Queen, and I'm just thinking, oh my gosh, there's a Dairy Queen in Boston, we've got to stop. Which, how many of you have ever been in a place like Boston, New York, Paris, France, or whatever, and you find yourself eating at McDonald's or Subway? I mean, it's just one of those things that, why would you want to do those things? But the Dairy Queen is so comfortable to me. All I wanted was a vanilla ice cream cone. All I wanted was to have that craving. And so as we're going out to some local fair in Wellesley, as we're going out to some wonderful experience in this, you know, city I've never been to before, except when I was a very small child, all I want is this ice cream cone, this Blizzard from Dairy Queen. Because it's great. I mean, Dairy Queen Blizzards, if there was a actual Blizzard of the Month club that I could join, I would be a part of that club. But it started to dominate. I remember thinking, I didn't really talk much about it. I probably did to Lindsay a little bit, about, I just want a Blizzard. And unfortunately, the Dairy Queens up near Boston closed down for the winter, because who wants a Blizzard when there's a Blizzard outside? And it is a stand. There's no inside sitting. It's all ice cream all the time, except during wintertime when I couldn't get my Blizzard. And so as we're sitting down for dinner, I remember as we're driving through Wellesley, as we're doing shopping, all I can think about is, man, some ice cream sounds really good. This is, you know, really, really good. And it's true not only with ice cream. I mean, obviously, ice cream is one of God's finer creations. But the cravings that are inside of us that control us, this is not just with ice cream, but this is a lot of different stuff. And Paul talks about, in 1 Timothy in general, Paul is addressing a community where they are. 1 Timothy is this really interesting book with a lot of different statements, such as women shouldn't speak in church, various things like that we have a hard time with. But it's also got these redeeming things like, don't ever let anyone look down upon you because you are young. Now, I'm guessing for the young females in the room, you probably really enjoy the part about don't let anyone look down upon you because you are young, and you probably really don't enjoy the part about no female should speak in church. And those of you who have been in the Bridge for a long time know Terry Swan was a pretty darn good preacher who spoke in church. And so it's this really interesting book that we have to look at from the standpoint that Paul is talking about a bunch of people who are experiencing a lot of different cravings for life. And they're trying to figure out what life is. And it's the church in Ephesus, and he sends Timothy there. So he's writing to Timothy about all of these instructions that he ought to give the church for their specific situations. The women, for example, were all involved in this Phoenician cult that the Greeks renamed the cult of Diana. And it was really popular amongst especially younger women because it promised safety during childbirth. And it promised that the goddess Diana would be with you during childbirth, it would keep your baby safe, it would keep you safe, when at a time when infant mortality and even mother mortality rates during delivery were really, really high. And so they all started getting involved in this cult of Diana because they wanted Diana to protect them. The cult encourages things like sexual promiscuity, encourages a gaudy lifestyle. And so when he starts saying about, well, women should not wear all this expensive jewelry, they should be loyal to one person, they should absolutely marry and have kids, it's not necessarily, okay, this is the eternal realm of all time because women shouldn't speak. It is the, well, look, this is the distraction you guys have got. And this is a big-time distraction. This is a craving that people are trying to find meaning in as they go forward because there are a lot of different rules. If you like that one, if you really want to go with the, well, women shouldn't speak in church, women shouldn't wear jewelry, all those kind of different things, well, you got to look at yourself too and say, you're not really supposed to use your money for you. And that's a big crux of what Paul finds in life because throughout the whole of chapter 6, a little of chapter 5, and even beyond, he starts talking about rich people. And Ephesus is a very rich town. And Paul's argument, you've heard the, you know, statement before that the love of all money is the root of all evil. And this is where that comes from. And that's an uncomfortable statement as well. And so 1 Timothy is this really kind of awkward book for us. And then we have these really redeeming things about don't look down on young people, that the church has the one true teaching that Jesus Christ is the only way. These things we like to pull out of it, and we like to leave a lot of different parts out. And we especially like to leave the parts about money out. Because in the passage we just read, the interesting, you know, it says, for the people who are wealthy, use your money for good. Use your money to uplift the community. Use all this different stuff. The interesting thing that I want to point out, though, is that Paul never says, don't be wealthy. There's a lot of passages in the Gospels that Jesus talks about that more blessed is the woman who gives the one coin because that's all she has versus the person who kind of throws in the coin because he has more. He tells the rich young ruler, you know, go give everything you have and to the poor and follow me. And so there's different arguments that Jesus just doesn't like wealthy people. And in the political climate we're in, there's, you know, we call it class warfare that's going on, which is, you know, it's just kind of, and they're not silly arguments, but the people on radio make them into these little hyped up things. And there's just people saying that, well, everybody hates wealthy people. Well, that doesn't jive with the notion of the church. That does not jive with the notion of Jesus Christ. And so Paul continues this on. He never says, don't be wealthy. And John Wesley actually takes this theologically and makes this great three-part statement and says, earn all you can, save all you can, give all you can. Because he's dealing with people where their cravings are. Paul is reaching out to these Ephesian people where their cravings are. He knows in all of life, as Jesus said, there's going to be poor people, there's going to be wealthy people. There's going to be people who are addicted to jewelry. There's going to be people who don't think marriage is not allowed in the church. There's going to be people who don't think women should speak. There's going to be a lot of people who think women should speak. There's going to be all sorts of different folks. And so Paul is addressing these wealthy people where they are. Because he's never going to convince them, everything you have, give it all away. That's not the way we're wired. Maybe that's the way we should be, but I'm not sure that's the way we're totally wired. We'll talk about that in a little bit as it relates to ice cream, actually. But Paul is meeting these people where they are and saying, you've got a lot of money. That means you've got a lot of influence. That means there's a lot of good you can do in the world. For all of those in the median income, yeah, you're comfortable. There's a lot of good you can do in the world. For all of those who are poor, remember the widow's mite. There's a lot of good you can do in the world. What are you doing there? Our cravings are what control us. And it's an interesting thing as I started thinking about this, that the more we seek to attain, the more what we seek to attain controls us. This is a little thing. I always give Shelby Renton, it's funny in our worship teams, one meeting we came in there, and it was me, Melissa Dobbs, Mark Moreland, and Shelby Renton. I think you were on vacation at the time, and so he wasn't in there at the time. And so Mark Moreland pulls out his iPad, Melissa Dobbs pulls out her iPad, I pull out my iPad, and Shelby pulls out this laptop that was about this big. It kind of looked like the original Dell or something. And ever since then, we always had this joke about, well, if you had an iPad, think about what you'd be able to do. And if you had an iPad and all this. And so we started thinking about, you know, Shelby's desire for an iPad. And if you really had this craving for an iPad, say it could be a big house, it could be a car, it could be anything that you're after. But Shelby's desire for an iPad is going to then dominate if I only had an iPad. And so every decision then becomes, well, how do I get the iPad? You can take it the same way of, if I only had a drink. You can take it the same way of, if my house were only a little bit bigger, I would be happy. If I had a cool car, chicks would dig me. Even more than they already do, obviously. But these if-only statements, the ones about, if I only had this, I would be happy. The thing I'm going through, and I can admit this about myself, is about our house, that I'm thinking if I had a fence to where my daughter could go run out and play and we wouldn't have to worry about her going out, if we had a room that looked a little nicer, if we had different stuff around our house, if our toilet didn't leak, different things like that that I'm trying to work on and fix. But if it were only like this, then I'm sure our life would be great. If this room were picked up, I'm sure our life would be great. If I could only get my office cleaned up, then my life would, work would be great. And it's these if-only statements of attaining these different things. And as I started thinking through this passage, I realized that those things control my decisions, that I really have no control of my life when these things I'm trying to attain are controlling. Now, there are very good goals. And that's how businesses are successful. That's how churches are successful. They set goals and they work those, guide their decisions. And I think what Paul is trying to say here is that if you want to have life and life to the fullest, it's got to matter what your goals are. What is controlling you? And what he continues to say in this passage is that if your goal is to give of yourself, if your goal is to invest in community and in people, if your goal is to be present with other people, then you are going to actually take control of life. Because when you're giving, you have the control, you have the power. If I go down to the Samaritan Inn and I am pouring myself out, I have chosen to pour myself out to the Samaritan Inn, to those people. I have chosen to love those people. I'm in complete control of all of my decisions. If I'm seeking an iPad, Apple is in control of all of my decisions. And they're in control of anything anyway, so it wouldn't be that different. But when you're choosing to give, you're choosing to take control of your life. You're choosing to have the life that is meant to be lived. And the one deep conclusion that I want you to walk away from here today that I came out of this passage with is that your life, now take this, this is very serious. Your life is meant to be more valuable than a vanilla ice cream cone. There was a study done in 2005, I'm going to look at my notes for this because this is the scientific part. In 2005, in London, England, the Institute of Psychiatry in London ran this experiment using these brain imaging machines that were designed to study the effects of concussions and other brain injuries. And they decided to take these brain imaging machines where they could see the activity of the lobes and the neurons firing in the brain. And they hooked it up to these people, about, probably 100 people, different things, with different, they had the control subjects, if you remember the scientific method from high school. And they gave them all a vanilla ice cream cone. And some of them, they gave a bowl of vanilla ice cream. They had different ways. But most people, except for the control group, were eating ice cream. And so as they took one scoop of yummy vanilla ice cream, that I'm sure was from Dairy Queen because it was good, their frontal lobes just started firing, started going off. And science has figured out that the frontal lobes of our brain are the ones that fire when we are experiencing pleasure. And the same, when the frontal lobes fire, it releases from the hypothalamus this hormone, I think, called oxytocin. And oxytocin is what makes us feel good. It calms our nerves. It takes fear away. It's actually the same thing as if you've ever known somebody who unwinds with a glass of wine at the end of the day. That's oxytocin. When you win the lottery and you feel really good, or someone gives you money, oxytocin. When you've had a pleasurable experience with someone from the opposite sex that you're married to, that's oxytocin. When you've had an experience looking at someone pleasurable across the room that you're not married to, That's oxytocin. It's called the cuddle hormone. It's most often thought of in romantic encounters. It's evolutionary speaking. It's what keeps the race going. It's what draws us together, that we see something pleasurable, it gives us a pleasurable experience, the rest of our brain remembers that it was a pleasurable experience, and we go and we seek more experiences like that. From a theological perspective, it means we really like to take stuff, and we really like to get stuff. But take another experiment that took these results, and I thought, this is really interesting the way, because all of this experiment proved was what every woman could have told you from the beginning of time. Ice cream makes you happy. And so they proved ice cream makes you happy. And so this other group decided, well, what else does, you know, we're just curious, what else, what other ramifications does this have? We know that the pleasure spots are in the front of the brain. If those fire up, we know something is pleasurable. It releases oxytocin. It goes to the rest of our nerves. And it deadens fear. That's why you'll still talk to a woman. That's why you'll still talk to the person you're in love with, you know, when you're first starting out, is because the oxytocin helps alleviate fear. It builds up trust, and that's the reason why you're able to immediately bond. Love at first sight is, you know, oxytocin working to establish a little more trust. But so they took this a little bit further and said, well, what other context is oxytocin relief? What other context do we experience this pleasurable experiences? And the number one area where oxytocin is released in the highest amounts is during childbirth. That when a woman is going into labor, the oxytocin actually helps start the contractions, and then it's released at an extremely high level while you're giving birth to a child. And this is why they say that some C-section births, that you don't necessarily feel the same euphoric feeling when you see the child with a C-section birth or with a complicated delivery, which obviously you still love the child, but you don't experience necessarily this euphoria because your oxytocin levels haven't been building up. And that's, I firmly believe that God designed it this way so that people would have more than one kid. Because if you go through that experience, most people will not tell you how painful their childbirthing experience was. They'll describe how beautiful it was when they saw the kid. You don't remember all the pain you went through. You don't remember all of the suffering that you went through to birth this kid out. And kids, be appreciative of your parents for all of this, by the way, at least your mom for this. But there's this instant bond. There's this instant trust. There's this instant love. Because your body's been designed to release a hormone that allows you to trust, allows you to love, allows you to be with that person fully. The other one, connected with the same thing as what I mentioned about falling in love. And this is not necessarily the I'm seeking pleasure experience of love that is so out there. This is the kind of love in which I hold my wife's hand and I cuddle with him and I am infatuated by her and I love seeing her, and every time she walks into a room, my heart skips a beat. That's oxytocin at work. And it lowers our guard a little bit so we can trust other people. I learned about trust when I got married. I don't think I ever knew about trust until I got married. And all of a sudden, I'm living with someone who could stab me in my sleep, perhaps. I never would have thought you would have done that. But, you know, it's just this intimate time to where all of a sudden, everything you're doing is so together. You're cooking together. You're watching TV together. Everything is so together. And so I never understood God, you know, trusting God, I don't think, until I got married. And when I learned about the science of all this, it just seems so engaging that we're designed to find pleasure in trusting. And that when we lower our, that we're designed to lower our guard in trusting. And once we trust another individual, once we let them in, we experience a release of oxytocin, more oxytocin that comes out, and we experience pleasure from that relationship. And it's the same way in a great friendship, in a best friend kind of situation, or in a close community, in a small group kind of situation, that you go to those situations and you experience trust and you experience intimacy and you experience a God fellowship in those situations. Your brain remembers that. It catalogs it away. You remember what your body felt like, and you seek that again. And you seek community. You seek close friendships. You seek relationships. You seek a relationship with Christ again because of the way you felt in that moment. Another interesting thing is that they went and surveyed people's brains who were doing community service. And I've said in the service before that the number one way that psychologists and psychiatrists will tell you to bust out of depression is to go do Habitat for Humanity or go serve people where you can build relationships and to do good for other people. And apparently that's not just a whim or some, you know, quack theory. That's scientifically proven that when they hooked up brain scanners to people who had just done community service, they found that their oxytocin level and their neuron level going on in the frontal lobe was incredibly high. Because not only were they forming relationships, eye-to-eye relationships with the people that they were serving, there was just something intrinsic that they were giving to somebody else, that they felt pleasure at giving to somebody else. They felt better about themselves. And they took the levels from the people who had been given a lot of money and eaten ice cream, and they put them up against the levels of people who were in really good relationships and people who had just been serving and giving out in the world. And the level of oxytocin, the level of neuron patterns in the pleasure part of the brain was so incredibly higher over here that it makes me wonder if we're not designed to be generous, if we're not designed to be in relationship, if we're not designed to love and to speak of this community that Paul speaks of that is life. Because he is talking to the rich people in this situation, but I think he could be talking to anyone and say, whatever resources you have, if you really want to live, then be generous with those. Because we talk about seize the day, carpe diem, seize the day, take hold of your life. And that's usually a good experience. It's a pleasurable experience. It's something where I'm in control. And Paul is saying in this situation, and science even backs it up, that if you really want to take hold of your life, then whatever it is you have, that you give it to others. And Paul says you give it in the name of Christ. That you are generous with your soul, you're generous with your time, you're generous with whatever it is you have, maybe it's money, whether it's something else, that your lifestyle becomes one of generativity. Creating opportunities to serve other people, to love other people, to be in community with other people. Because I mentioned it last week, you find people who have been on mission trips who are just craving that experience again. It's like a drug. But as I said before, the way things succeed is to set goals and to go forward with them. It's just a matter of what goals you're trying to achieve. Are your goals lined up with the generous nature of Jesus Christ? Are your goals lined up with whatever you want them to be? Because when Shelby's seeking the iPad or I'm seeking my house to be fixed or different things, that if I'd only be happier with those and I get them, what's next? What's the next great high that I'm seeking? What's the next purchase that can make me feel good? What's the next person I can get something from? And I think that Paul is telling us to not settle for that lesser high because it would make us feel good. There's no denying about that. Pleasure sparks when you have ice cream. But don't settle for a lesser high than the bigger, more permanent high of Jesus Christ and living a life of generousness, generosity. Because that's what Christ commands us to do. Christ commands us to give somebody else the ice cream cone. Christ commands us to break the bread for somebody else. Christ commands us to give of the resources we have. Christ commands us. We're even designed, I think, to be generous, to create pleasure for other people. And by doing that, we are then experiencing joy and experiencing pleasure. I think that's one of the reasons that most people enjoy communion so much. Because it's a radical experience where you are taking and giving at the same time. You're taking the grace and love of Jesus Christ, and you're experiencing this immense relief from our sins. We're remembering that we're forgiven. And I want you to hear that. You are forgiven. Doesn't that feel good to hear? Does it not soak into your soul? You are forgiven. At the same time you're hearing and taking that forgiveness, there's also this sense of giving yourself to God. I don't know if you feel that or not, but when I approach communion, I'm always seeking forgiveness. And whenever I take communion, I always leave feeling like I've left something at the altar, like I've left a part of me or something. And I hope that I maintain that feeling throughout the week or throughout the month until the next time. But communion allows me to leave something at the altar because that's what Christ did.
Thank you for listening to this message from Stonebridge United Methodist Church. Feel free to join us at our bridge service, a relaxing and rejuvenating worship experience built around soulful music and worship of Jesus Christ, Sunday mornings at 10:45. For more information, visit our website, mysumc.org. Have a blessed day.